Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today, Mike Seymour is going to speak with Alex Woodka, visual effects supervisor from Double Negative, on the film 2012. Before we start that, I thought I'd just mention, speaking of the FX Podcast, you know, we've been doing a lot of variety in the podcast lately, besides just interviews with filmmakers. I mean, most of you probably don't know the history of how we started doing podcasts. We recorded interviews with people to write stories. And Mike and I were actually driving back from Vegas, and I had covered an interview for him for a project. And we were listening to the audio recording of that in the car, and we both were struck with how interesting it was to actually hear the person talking directly about their passion for working on a project and the film. And we thought at the time podcasts were coming online, and we thought it would be good to have an option to present the speaker in an audio form that you could actually hear them talking directly about the project and get into more detail than you really want to sit down and read. So I hope you're enjoying that. We're also trying to cover a bunch of things happening in the industry. We've got a bunch of great stuff lined up, and we'll be talking about that in the coming weeks. Also, we do a lot of podcasts. We do Red Center Weekly, which is Jason Wingrove and Mike Seymour really digging into digital cinematography. It started out as a red-centric podcast and has really grown to explore all of the forms of digital cinematography. And I think you'll find it very easy to stay up to date with the current development of Red, which we know is constantly evolving. Mike and Jason really stay on top of this, as well as all the developments in that area. Red Center has been a very popular podcast for us. In the audio realm of podcasting, we also do a podcast over at our sister site, FXPHD, which is really designed just to give you kind of an insight. Mike Seymour and John Montgomery talk to each other about stuff going on in the term, in the classes, in the industry. It's a real casual, chatty type podcast designed for students to kind of get together with the founders and talk about and hear what they're talking about in the classes. Video-wise, we do FX Guide TV in English and in Spanish, two separate products. And FX Guide TV, I would recommend very highly checking out the last two episodes, 70 and 71. 71, both of those have really, really great Nuke tips in them. Really interesting to see how people are using Nuke and expanding on Nuke, and clear to see why Nuke is just becoming such a strong, strongly adopted product across pipelines around the world. A lot of really clever solutions being built into the product and expanded on by customers. So check those out. So anyway, let's jump into this podcast now that I've promoted all the other podcasts that we do. And Mike Seymour with Alex Woodka from Double Negative.
So your role on the film was visual effects supervisor, and I was wondering if we could start for DNEG. I was wondering if we could start on the discussion of St. Peter's, because you basically got to wreak havoc with one of the most sacred religious sites of the Catholic Church, if I'm not mistaken.
That's absolutely correct. Yes.
Now we obviously are in a sort of a big Hollywood blockbuster kind of world of visual effects. So the mandate, I'm sure, was to be very visually graphic and very strong. And I'm wondering how much your vision of St. Peter's and the Vatican is sort of accurate, because obviously it's not a documentary. We're more interested in drama than we are accuracy. But I mean, how visually accurate were you?
We had to be pretty damn accurate with our sort of rendition of St. Peter's. You know, it's a location that a lot of people are familiar with. So everything that we did, just to kind of sell what happens afterwards, has to be rooted in some sort of reality, and quite a firm sense of reality as well.
How hard was it to get the reference for that? Because I know from the work that was done around the Da Vinci Code that the Catholic Church generally doesn't open its doors to film crews. Did you have any...
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's very, very tough indeed. We had to sort of use a lot of photography that had been kind of shot with people posing as, just tourists, really. So to kind of gather all that reference was kind of one of the harder things to do. And that was kind of especially true of some of the interior shots we were doing of, there's the Sistine Chapel, for instance, with that famous roof that we had to kind of rebuild pretty much for the shot where a giant crack kind of runs down it. So kind of things like that, it was very difficult to get
Well, let's discuss a shot like that, because that crack which separates man from God is very iconic. But of course, if you had full access to the roof, you could take all sorts of HDRs and the sort of things that we know Dienig is very good at doing in terms of the work you've done on other films for gathering very detailed HDRs and stuff. But presumably in this case, you didn't have that luxury. So how did you get the kind of visual detail? Because it's a very detailed model and a very precise rendering.
No, absolutely. I mean, we were fortunate enough that we had some sort of fairly sort of low res snaps of of the ceiling itself, and then it was really up to a team of texture artists and matte painters using kind of reference from books and things like that to sort of actually to kind of paint in the resolution so that it would hold up for any sort of push-ins that we did on the roof or anything like that, or any sort of long lens shots kind of looking up at the roof, so that we could have enough detail. They would essentially go in and just kind of paint up the detail for us.
Well, that shot is, especially the crack close-up, is pretty much an entirely, actor-free shot, obviously looking up at the roof.
Mm.
The actual collapse of the dome in particular involves a huge crowd of people and a lot of actors. I'm wondering, what were the elements you had to work with? Was it that you shot a lot of green screen actors? Were you using some kind of artificial massive type solution? How did you go about populating the environments?
Yeah, I mean, we had kind of a bunch of elements of green screen crowds to work with initially. Obviously, kind of as we went through the sequence, some of the shots changed. Some of the camera sort of lineups changed a little bit as well, and we ended up applying some camera moves to otherwise static shots, which generally kind of negated our sort of use of some of the green screen elements, at which point we switched to largely just kind of mo-capped crowds. We did a big mo-cap session and kind of threw in as many sort of actions as we could, kind of representative of people kind of, sort of running out of the way of this dome, tripping over, stumbling across each other. We didn't really end up using much by way of massive. It was a bit more of a kind of hand-placed orchestration of elements in the end, sort of mocap cycles.
And what about collision problems with the CG and those mocap? I mean, did you have collision issues?
The leading wave of people running away kind of generally okay in terms of collisions, but there's a wave of people right at the back of the shot that are getting pretty much just squashed by bits of masonry and the dome sort of rolling forward. So what we did for that is we used a tool called Endorphin, which allows you to kind of pretty much create sort of dynamic mocap, if you like, or mocap that's reactive to external forces. Using Endorphin, we could pretty much have our mocap cycles of people running, and then if a giant piece of masonry lands on someone, we could switch to the procedural behavior where Endorphin would generate motion for them actually being knocked over and squashed. So we ended up using that quite extensively towards the back of the shot.
It's actually not as simple as it sounds, because presumably there's a fine line to be walked between something looking completely fake because a piece of masonry or whatever hits somebody and they just disappear, and at the other extreme, of course, you don't want something too graphic because the audience doesn't want to, or the film doesn't probably want to sort of get a high rating because you've got sort of blood and guts effectively.
Absolutely.
You kind of need luckily, to elegantly kill people off.
That's it. Luckily a lot of the shot is kind of set in darkness. We investigated sort of lighting schemes early on. The sequence is meant to take place kind of, very early morning. Effectively what we did is, we started off with a look that was quite subdued, with not much by way of lighting, just some ambient lighting. But obviously you can't really read what's happening there. So we started throwing in some dynamic lighting effects, sparks and showers of sparks and kind of little internal explosions inside of the basilica, and it was kind of those little bits and pieces we could use to sort of highlight the plight of some of the characters. We were generally keeping everything in darkness, but then highlighting some of the actions that weren't too, you know, graphic with a bit more key lighting. So we could keep things largely in the dark, which helped us with the rating.
And with the with any kind of destruction sequence like this, the debris and to a certain extent the dust and sort of general stuff that's kicked up from it is really pivotal in selling the shot. How did you set that up in terms of when I say collision, I mean like correctly interacting with the theoretically solid people?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of did a lot of hierarchical simulations on this show, especially for St. Peter's. You know, we have huge chunks of wall falling down, which then in turn holding a smaller hierarchy of objects that kind of then it splits itself apart. And all of those are reacting to certain triggers in the world. You know, we have an idea of glue strength between all the pieces so that when certain external forces kind of push themselves on these objects, then they, you know, they'll start to come apart. So we use the same thing for all the crowds of people.
The sequences before, I mean, we've been talking about the, you know, the absolute crashing of the dome down on the crowd, which is quite dark, but there are shots that precede it where it's starting to go. I mean, literally like shots slightly earlier. The building isn't really breaking apart there, but there is that sense of it being more than a facade because there seems to be sort of an internal structure that's on almost a shake and stuff. Yet these are meant to be sort of presumably stone-built buildings. Was any of the dynamics a challenge?
Absolutely, yeah. Because, I mean, obviously, if it's just a sort of a brick building, then that's fine. You just procedurally model a whole bunch of bricks that just fall apart. But when you've got these huge sort of expanses of stone, obviously then you're into sort of cracking problems. So we had to develop a series of volumetric shatter tools to be able to, you know, actually just break up the stonework realistically. And then behind the stonework, you know, I mean, what we were finding early on was that, sure, we can break up all these large stone facades, but then when they crumble apart, they, you know, they're starting to look a little bit uninteresting. There's not enough visual detail in there. So then we started to put in layers of masonry actually kind of behind that to try and sell the, you know, sell the detail within these models. So there's, you know, there's several layers deep of different things that break up and fall apart just to give it that sort of visual complexity, which, you know, helps to sell the scale as well.
Did you derive the final kind of, I guess, dynamics of that shot quite quickly, or was it a moving feast? In other words, did you find that you had to go down a number of different paths, or was that sort of side-on collapse always storyboarded or prevised from the outset?
Yeah, I mean, we had pretty good sort of previs for the sequence as to, you know, exactly what they wanted to happen in each shot. It was largely kind of without a huge amount of breakup. So, you know, the larger pieces of breakup were sort of put forward to us and we could actually see what they should be. Although, you know, obviously when we kind of got into that, with, you know, physics being physics, it's quite hard to sort of emulate dynamics sometimes. You know, especially stuff that's actually kind of has been pre-vised out quite meticulously. So our initial breakup was done, you know, with a lot of keyframing, just to kind of give it the initial impulse and make stuff move and fall in the right direction. After we'd kind of got that established, you know, then our secondary and tertiary dynamics could kick in and take over.
Because that's the kind of fine line you walk, isn't it, between the simulation world and the articulated keyframed world. And the simulation world gives you accuracy, but may not do what is, you know, creatively or cinematically valid.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was a big challenge for the sequence is, you know, kind of as you're saying, actually kind of get the right sort of, you know, character to the shot, get the right sort of shapes and feel to the shot. But at the same time have the dynamics do a kind of almost like a supporting role of actually kind of providing all that sort of visual complexity that you'd expect from a crumbling facade.
So with the perhaps only tenuous link that both are disastrous for the characters involved. You've gone from one extreme with this sequence to the other major sequence that the company worked on, because the other major sequence was the Yellowstone escape sequence. And the contrast here being that whereas one is stone buildings built by man seen at sort of in a dark environment, as you said yourself, when we move to Yellowstone, we've actually got natural environments and it's full light pretty much. You're you've gone from one extreme to the other.
Absolutely, yeah.
How did you approach that whole sequence? I mean, and literally how much of the valley, as it were, that are being firebombed or meteored between, how much of that is digital and how much is live action?
So there was a pretty extensive second unit shoot out in Kamloops in Canada, which is doubling up as Yellowstone, involving, you know, the RV, it's kind of running across the countryside. Now, I mean, what we found was that, you know, we could use the photography pretty much, you know, as it was. There are a lot of elements where we were required to kind of really break this landscape apart and start running. In one instance, there's a giant sort of bit of seismic activity whereby a huge crack starts to run across the terrain that John Cusack in his RV is traveling across. So, I mean, in that sort of instance, we'd have to sort of do a bunch of projections from the plate onto some terrain that we'd built to match. And then, you know, kind of with that sort of projected geometry, then break that apart. So there are a lot of instances where we're using the plate photography, but really kind of building environments from that, which would then later on be destroyed.
I mean, camera mapping or camera projection work is best done, I guess, when the camera isn't moving too much because of the nature of the projection. But for some of these shots, because Roland Emmerich typically is a crowd-pleasing kind of, you know, action flick kind of guy, the camera is no longer restricted to what you might describe as a sort of a stationary camera. It's flying across the terrain.
Correct.
Did that necessitate a digital solution, or were you just still trying to use cards or something else to use live action in there?
No, we had someone over there who was shooting a lot of photography. Everything was shot in the Genesis, and we actually got him. We got our guy up in the helicopter with a space cam Genesis mount, and got him to shoot a whole bunch of tiles for areas that we knew we were going to have to do projections later on. So we had a pretty extensive survey of the terrain. So you know we could rebuild the environments pretty cleanly with these static feed shot tiles. But you know, in other instances, we didn't really have that luxury, and we're just kind of left with straight, you know, photography on a moving camera platform. So then, obviously, you're dealing with all sorts of inherent problems like built-in motion blur in the image, which obviously makes life a little bit harder. But when we got into situations like that, we'd process the photography, remove as much blur as possible, paint in the details that were missing or any occlusion areas, and just kind of proceed that way.
I mean, the thing for me that makes those shots remarkable is the volumetrics. They just have such wonderful depth properties between the close-up stuff and those slowly moving distant properties, which is so reminiscent of the volcanic stuff we saw with Mount St. Helens and other places. Was there any new volumetrics work developed for this, or were you using the existing tools at the DNEG?
Yeah. I mean, it was a kind of an evolutionary process, really. We've got some pretty strong volumetric tools. We've got a really good fluid simulator that we've written. We've also got a sort of fairly mature volume rendering solution as well. So, you know, we could leverage those pretty much as they were. Although what we were finding was because of the sheer scale of some of these shots, you know, we have these giant pyroclastic clouds pretty much filling screen. And because of their scale, you know, we had to really have a lot of detail in each single grid. So what we ended up doing was actually kind of going back into the core architecture of our volumetric renderer and really optimizing it to be able to handle these huge data sets. So there's a lot of memory sort of memory mapping and a lot of sort of work done on really trying to sort of hone the kind of ability of the renderer to be able to support massive data sets. So, I mean, that was the main work, really.
Was the was this sort of being fed into some kind of RenderMan point cloud solution? I mean, what was the to handle this huge volumetric stuff? Was it your renderers? What sort of renderer was being used to solve this problem? Because there is a lot of data.
Yeah, it was a huge amount of data, and I think that was kind of one of the biggest challenges on the show, was to really kind of find a way of being able to process these huge amounts of data. Because it's kind of one thing to actually kind of simulate enormously, you know, huge kind of grids of information. But then it's another thing to be able to actually try and render that within available memory. You know, we have on our farm, for these purposes, you know, most of our racks have at least 16 gigs of RAM, and we're finding that a single frame at some points just wasn't actually going through. It would take up all the RAM and just sit there, and that would be that. So, yeah, to be able to get the renderer to support that involved a lot of optimizations.
Was this something that would be pertinent for using brick maps or not? Was this much more... because there's really two stages, isn't there? There's like the solution stage in terms of getting the simulations, and then, of course, the render stage in terms of placing that into the relevant camera.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of something that, you know, we really thought hard about. Unfortunately for this show, we didn't have the time to, you know, to tweak our format, file formats, to be able to support that. But, you know, in hindsight, that probably would have helped us quite a bit, just in terms of having LODs in the right place, and that whole sense of an automatic LOD would be kind of good. Although we had something that was sort of probably not similar, but kind of something along the same sort of line of thinking, in that we ended up a lot of our renders are tiled pretty heavily. So, you know, instead of trying to compute a full frame using your memory, we're just kind of computing a portion of the frame, rendering that, and then moving on to the next tile, and then rendering that and compositing everything back together to create the final frame at the end.
Right. And you said that the footage that you were working with as the base level was shot on Genesis. So presumably you were provided with stuff that was in the panel LUT format, and that you were, was it, I mean, mm-hmm. I presume it wasn't shot linear, or rather it wasn't stored linear off the Genesis, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
So what was your pipeline? Were you converting that to an OpenEXR format, or were you working with converting that to some kind of linear? And what was the post pipeline?
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty much exclusively EXR all the way through. So our studio department would convert all of the images into an EXR format, and then they'd pretty much stay in that format. All of our renders are done in EXR as well. So we comped pretty much exclusively in that kind of space.
But nonetheless, you're only getting 1920 by 1080 albeit a 10-bit kind of file. That's still all you're getting for those base plates.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Did that limit you at all in terms of, for example, the first sequence we discussed, which was at night, was that all shot for night, or did you have any grading issues, or did you find it was a flexible enough file format for you once you converted it?
Yeah, no. Initially, in the St. Peter's sequence, we had kind of one shot that was done actually kind of on film, you know, where we had to sort of do a day for night for that. And obviously, you know, being film, that's, you know, we can scan that, and we don't have any of the inherent issues with that. The rest of the sequence, we didn't really have to do too much of, you know, a heavy grade, and certainly on Yellowstone, there wasn't that much to do with sort of dynamic grading. So we sort of pretty much just worked with that far formula all the way through and didn't have too many problems.
And you said you had someone on set for the Yellowstone stuff. I was wondering, did you rely primarily on just the raw footage that you were getting to feed in for the camera solves, or did you have other witness cameras or any other techniques for sort of determining a base geometry upon which to do the fit to?
Yeah, so we, you know, we had generally on the big shots in Yellowstone, they would be running A, B, C, and sometimes D cameras on the action. So there was a lot of different angles we could use to sort of, you know, really calculate the geometry. And in fact, we used a lot of software that we developed on Bond, on Quantum of Solace, in terms of stereo matching and stereo computation of cameras to be able to generate some of the terrain for us, which was really useful. And in fact, when we sent our Wrangler out there, we gave him specific instructions that when he's shooting stills of the environments, he actually kind of shoots stereo pairs, so that we could later kind of pull that information back into our software, which is called Double Vision, and actually calculate some of the terrain for us. So it's kind of like a cheap LiDAR
process. Were you doing that stereo? Were you doing that stereo vision by doing a photo and then sort of moving on perhaps a horizontal rig to get to your secondary position, or was it a dual camera rig?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much just kind of shoot one picture, move around across a certain angle across your axis, and then shoot another still. So, you know, there wasn't really, using our software, we don't really need to have sort of, you know, a hugely complex rig for that. You can really just kind of run and gun with it.
Because it's a spatial analysis problem rather than any kind of stereoscopic. I mean, for an actual stereoscopic program, of course, you're very worried about all sorts of things to do with interocular, but this is more really a geometric solution.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, really what we're concerned with is getting just a calibration off of the images that are shot. In other words, finding exactly where the camera was after the fact between the stereo pairs. Once we got that information, then, you know, it doesn't... As long as you're within a certain baseline of angle between the images, it doesn't really matter too much, as long as you know what that angle is.
Alex, if you were giving advice to someone going out on set to do your measurements for you, given DNEG's incredible R&D that's got you to the point you're at, if you had to sort of summarize the importance of on-set gathering, is it more important to be gathering geometrically split pairs to help solve geometry these days, or is it more important to be doing HDR work to capture accurate lighting, or is it more a matter of sort of where the camera was and understanding the lenses and stuff? And what is it that you could kind of give advice to someone if you're going out there, if all else fails, mate, do this?
Yep. I mean, generally, the primary thing for us is to go out and gather HDRI information. So, you know, we generally use an 8mm fisheye, and we shoot bracket exposures to gather our HDRIs, and that's kind of really important for us. We need that information for our lighting pipeline pretty heavily. So that's kind of primary. Secondary is really kind of, even before you get into shooting split pairs for, you know, sort of reconstruction of geometry, we kind of like to get a good set of tiles for use in our environments, our environment work, that's also really important. So when we're shooting that, we generally request two sets for a given panorama. The first is on a sort of wide-angle lens, and then the second is a bit more sort of in-depth on a longer lens. And those, I think the HDRIs and also the tiles of the environment, those are probably the two most important things for us to be able to reconstruct a scene.
So let's just take a step back, and now that obviously the film is at about release stage, I mean, on a project of this size for you guys with these two major sequences, how long was it in production for you, and how big was your team?
We started in late November, just really kind of doing bidding, breaking down the sequences that had been awarded, and kind of getting into detail then. And we kind of wrapped just a couple of, well, it was probably about a month ago now. So in total, I guess you're looking at around 9 months, something like that, from start to finish.
So you got to take some advantage of the rescheduling of the release date to give you a bit more time to work on the
effects.
Right.
Yeah, which is kind of good, because, I mean, as obviously as we went along, some of the shots got bigger and bigger and bigger, and the brief got wider and wider. So obviously that sort of extra time allowed us to sort of comfortably fit that extra work in.
Yeah.
In
terms of the team size?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the team size, we were running sort of at the peak of production to around 90 people in total. And the split is kind of generally about 30 kind of compositors and around 60 3D people.
And the pipeline, I presume, is using your in-house tools fairly much now.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. On the 3D side of things, we will generally run Maya, but then we have a whole bunch of custom tools and different things like that will hang off the back of that.
Yeah. I think that the work that you guys have done in building up the sort of the tool base and stuff that you've done has been extraordinary, and it's obviously building, I mean, or in this case destroying on what had been built before. But also congratulations, because clearly the shots are very strong visually, and both of your sequences feature strongly in the trailer, which is always a good sign in terms of how a director must like a sequence.
Yes.
It's always good for the morale of the team to be featured in the trailer.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, look, Alex, thank you so much for taking time to walk us through those shots. We really do appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
Well, thanks for that, Alex and Mike. I wanted to say that I mentioned at the beginning we've got some great podcasts coming up. I figured I might as well tease one of those while I'm ending this podcast. At a lot of these meetings lately that we've been to, the VES Production Summit, they had a quality forum a while back over in Hollywood. Many people have been saying color workflow on feature films is reinventing the wheel every time. Every show is reinventing the process. So we decided to get to the bottom of that and have a little more in-depth discussion about color and workflow on feature films, especially in the from acquisition digitally change through post. So we're going to speak with Brian Gaffney and Dan Line coming up soon at Technicolor Creative Bridge about their processes and kind of some of the caveats and thoughts about the industry and how the digital cinematography is evolving and how people can best do workflow to guarantee themselves excellent results. So look for that coming up soon. For Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.